good evening. Come in, come in. Welcome to House of Mystery.
Do you have any rooms available?
Yes, we have room for you.
How much for one night?
For you is free. One night. It is raining. And besides, you have a certain quality that we need.
For free? Thanks, man. You're a lifesaver. Man, this place is creepy. It's out in the middle of nowhere. You have any ghosts?
Ghost? No. No ghost. Not yet. But we have everything else. We've got UFO. We've got conspiracy. We've got true crime. Alternate history. But no. No ghost as yet.
Thanks for the room. Do you mind taking me upstairs and showing me the room?
Yes. Yes, of course. This way to the elevator. Here we are. This room is for you.
Hey, you don't need to shove me. Man, this room is dark. I can barely see a thing. Are you sure this is my room?
What the hell is that, moving around in the dark?
Sir, the door seems to be locked from the outside.
Now we have ghost. Now it is your turn. Welcome. Will you be needing a room in the House of Mystery?
You have now entered the House of Mystery on KXIM 98.3 FM Iowa with your hosts Al Warren, Kev Thompson, and Julie Sav.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. Now, today we have Cutter Woods, author, and we mentioned him a little bit before, so we're going to be talking to him about his new book that just came out on the 17th here, Love and Death in the Sunshine State, the story of a crime. So welcome, Cutter Woods. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Always a pleasure. So now this is interesting. Now, is this your first book?
It is my first book. Yeah.
So that's an interesting. How did you get into writing? And I kind of know a little bit about this story, but I think it's kind of interesting. So tell us how you got to write this book and how it came about.
Sure. So, you know, I when I started this book, I'd graduated from college not too long before, was kind of, an English major, very typically at loose ends. I went down to see some family in Florida, and I happened to stay at this little motel on Anna Maria Island, which is on the Gulf Coast of Florida near Tampa. You know, didn't think too much about it, left and never really thought I would go back. And then some months later, I got this clipping in the mail. My mother had sent it, actually. And it just showed this motel where I'd stayed just covered in flames, just this huge mass of fire.
Ooh.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, that's strange. And as I kind of read more into this article, learned that this woman had disappeared. They'd been looking all over for her, and then this fire had kind of come out of nowhere. And what really caught my attention was just, one, this woman was just really a very kind of spectacularly interesting person, very, very loving, very thoughtful, very beloved in the community. And then so people's reactions to her disappearance were just absolutely strange. You know, I read some in the paper, and then when I went down and started interviewing people, because I really kind of got hooked. People were, they saw her at the dentist's office. They saw her at a bar with a man dressed like a pimp. They saw her at the Salvation Army in the Circle K convenience mart. Somebody saw her at the airport getting on a flight. The strangest one, I talked to a woman who was very convinced that very early on that Sabina had been murdered and that she was going to communicate from the afterlife via her pet parrot. So, when I realized the effect that this was having on the place, I just felt like there was something there that needed to be explored.
Well, that's kind of a strange scenario. Did you know her very well while you stayed there?
Not at all, not at all. And in fact, I think we might have crossed paths once when I was out looking at her pet parrot. And I think she might have been there too. But no, I didn't know her whatsoever, really.
Wow. So do you know what kind of made you want to find out kind of the truth or kind of go for the writing the,
Yeah.
was there a reason that drew you?
There was, in fact, and this is a decent part of the book as well. The, you know, when I kind of got down there, I was just initially I thought I would maybe write something about the way her disappearance had affected the community, and the way these people had kind of taken that space where there used to be a person and filled it with all of these fears and hopes. And the more I got into it, the more I realized there was a whole different story going on there. It was actually kind of about this woman's relationship. She'd moved in with a man 2 months before she disappeared. And it was kind of about the unraveling of that relationship. And it was, I guess what really hooked me was I also had just moved in with someone. My girlfriend then, now thankfully my wife, and we were going through some of these exact same struggles, The, oh, why are there dishes in the sink? Why is there hair in the drain? These things where, I would go through the court records. I remember going through the court records and seeing at one point in time, her boyfriend and like a previous altercation had said to someone, "Why do you defy me?" And that those words just echoed in my head all the time when I would go back home after interviewing people, and I'd, be in this house which just was no longer my house all by myself, no longer my own terrain that was shared. And I was just always thinking, "Why do you defy me?" So I felt a lot like my research into this was also kind of a very personal research about how to live how to be nice in a relationship, I guess, would be the blunt way to put it.
Well, it's always a process, right? To live with someone newly, and everybody kind of has their own lifestyle and habits, and it's a process. I don't. It's
Yeah,
very
process is a very kind way to put it.
well, because it's very seldom super easy. I mean, because the
Yeah.
passion and love wear off somewhat, and then you're dealing with like hair in the drain, or someone that doesn't do dishes, or someone that leaves their laundry on the floor. There's a, yeah, it's just
I should be clear, by the way. I should be clear. I was the one who wasn't doing dishes.
yeah. Well, I kind of figured
Yeah.
that. But that's just being human, and that's sort of what we do. Now, why do you think
Yeah.
now this woman was married as well as had the boyfriend? Is that true? So
That's true. Yeah, she.
I was going to say,
Go ahead.
where was the husband?
So they actually they still live together. And I he would never he was a very nice man, very kind to me. He actually let me stay at the motel while I was working on the project. But he didn't want to talk to me about his wife. I think he felt kind of that the case had been a little sensationalized in the local media, and he wasn't interested in partaking in it more. So I want to talk about him, kind of protect his privacy a little bit. But they had just become estranged. They'd been married for a while, and it had become clear that they were kind of still friends, still co-owners of this motel. or really very openly doing their own things.
Yeah, I understand that part. I know people that do that actually, and I just not. So he, but she actually had this boyfriend move in with her.
So she rented an apartment for the two of them to live together. So she had a house with her husband and an apartment also on the island with her boyfriend.
So she was busy.
She was, yes. Yes, she was. She was definitely a very somebody who didn't let time escape from her, you know?
Right. She was making the
So,
best
something
of
a
it.
lot of people told me, she was exactly making the best of her life and just a very passionate person.
Well, so now I know you're trying to keep the husband out of it and the name, all that, so, you know, so, but I was just, but just one thing I wanted to, so was he okay with her having a separate apartment with this boyfriend? Just, or do you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was very much a matter of contention. Not because I don't, my interpretation based on what people have told me, not because he was angry about the relationship, but I think actually because he cared about her and he felt like this boyfriend was bad news, possibly. So yeah, he asked that the boyfriend not be allowed to come to the motel at all. And that was kind of what drove them to get this apartment together.
Well, I mean, I can see that, but you know, but then can I ask, do you know why didn't they just divorce? Like, why not just, you know, go for the legal divorce and move on?
Great question. I can't say that I have the answer on that one. I don't know if anybody knows that, and I don't even know if they knew that, the answer to that one.
Because to me, that means if, you know, because if they're staying together for the motel, you know, for the business, that's one thing. But why not divorce and separate, and you can still be co-owners of the motel, and you can still run it and split profits. I mean, you don't have to be married to run a business with someone. So I just, that's curious to me, unless they kind of liked it this way.
Yeah, I mean, my impression was they kind of had a nice life, even if they were no longer romantically involved.
Oh, that's kind of
But
crazy.
you know,
Well,
yeah,
oh.
it's really it's hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, so now do we know how she met this boyfriend? How did he come into play? Where did he come from?
Great question. Yeah, so he actually he his name's William Cumber. He came down to the island in the early 2000s, kind of with a girlfriend from North Carolina. Did a number of different things. He had kind of a checkered past. He was, I think, he was arrested on a number of charges. And he showed up one day at the motel. He's a very good woodworker. He showed up at the motel asking if he could just do some odd jobs. And they took him on, and he met Sabina, who's the woman who went missing, and her husband Tom. And I think that day, or maybe 2 days later or something, the police showed up and arrested him. He had, yeah, turned out that they'd gotten the information to arrest him for an arson charge. And he was sent to prison, right? And then the strange and interesting thing here is that he, this is a very common thing, right? That he then wrote them a letter from prison just asking if they could, you know, asking them, thanking them for their help and asking them if they could help him out at all. You know, sending deodorant or shoes or things like that. And Tom, the husband, I think, was not so keen on this, but Sabina was a very, you know, the kind of person who would help anybody she thought was in need, particularly, I mean, especially she was very, very gung ho for animals, and I think just had a soft spot for anybody who needed help. So she wrote back to him and eventually, you know, would send him stuff. Eventually, I think went to see him in prison, and they kind of struck up a friendship. And when he would basically get released on furlough, he would come and do kind of like a work release sort of thing at the motel. And over the course of all of this, they fell in love, really. So that when he got out, she had this apartment there waiting for him.
Wow.
I'm
not sure that if I, you know, if I had an employee that I just hired, in 2 days he got arrested for arson and put in prison, I'm not sure that I would continue to use that employee.
You can see why Tom had some reservations about this whole thing.
It doesn't make sense. Two days or a couple of days, whatever it is, you're really not getting to know the person. It's not like you've been an employee for 5 years and you really know them, and so you want to help them. A couple of days is kind of like, oh, well, that was a bad choice. Mm-hmm. Move on.
Well, this Madeline Cumber, too, you know, it should be noted that he's a very, very pleasant man. People, fairly handsome. People describe him as handsome. And I think he explained things to her in a way that it made sense and didn't seem scary. You know, he didn't tell her about much of his criminal history. When he described setting fire to this previous building, you know, he said, oh, that was a place where they were selling drugs, and I was trying to do the community a favor. And it was only much later that anybody realized kind of what his past had been. And he'd been really in prison for most of his adult life.
Do we know kind of what his imprisonment has been? I mean, obviously there was arson, but was it violent criminal history, or was it just petty thief, or what? What
would he do? Oh, you know, it was everything. I went back. I ended up interviewing him a great deal, as well as another man who was a person of interest in the case. Person of interest kind of being a euphemism these days for suspect. So William's history was basically he committed one of the strangest crimes, I think, when he was born in Ohio and got married there, I think, at 18 or 19, and realized or thought that his wife was cheating on him. So, and he knew that if he wasn't locked up, he was going to do something he would regret. So he just drove across town and broke into someone's house. So he would get, and this is his narration of events, but so that he would get locked up to keep from doing any harm to his wife. But then instead of just going in and waiting for the police to arrive, he actually hid in a crawl space for a number of days in the house, you know, and he would come out when they were gone and kind of almost seemed like kind of like act like he lived there. And then when they came home, he would go back into the crawl space. So kind of just a peculiar way of going about things. Right.
Yeah.
And I think maybe because it was such a strange case that they really did kind of throw the book at him for that breaking and entering charge. He was in prison, I think, for pretty much 8 years. Got out, and then just kind of a whole series of violations, everything, you know, from punching someone in the parking lot of a grocery store to cultivating marijuana to driving without a seatbelt and fishing without a license, you know. Just seemed like if it was possible to get in trouble for doing it, he was going to find a way.
Yeah. But he hadn't murdered before, or at least that we know.
No. I mean, he had definitely shown some very violent tendencies. There was an affidavit, the thing I was describing earlier, there's an affidavit where he had basically taken someone by the throat and said, why did you defy me? And that is certainly, you know, any time someone puts their hands around somebody else's throat, that's a big signifier that they've got more serious intentions.
Yeah,
I'm not just saying that is like that's obvious, but there's really a connection between choking and later homicide.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So she gets him out of prison, and when he came out of prison, okay, so they've got the apartment. Did he work for the motel again, even though she was living with him? Like, did the ex-husband say it was okay? He can come to work here, or how did that go?
No, so he was banned from the motel. He'd been working while in prison, so he'd saved up some money, which he was living on for a while. And he also, he's a, I think I've said, he's an interesting guy. He's a self-taught artist, and he was trying to make a living selling his paintings on the island, or not his paintings, his drawings on the island, which I think was, as you might expect, maybe not going very well.
Yeah.
But he was, so he's an artist and woodworker, and he was trying to basically run his own business and make a living from that.
Well, so how long before he killed her or she went missing officially? Like how long did it last that it was kind of good in the apartment?
Yeah, I don't want to, you know,
give it
for
away.
The sake of readers, don't want to give away exactly what happened because they're, you know, the case was very much until, you know, it took about, the entire case took over 5 years to be resolved. Most people thought there was never going to be a resolution. And during that time, there were really three men who most people were fairly sure one of them had done it. I shouldn't cast William Cumber in all of the poor light here.
Right.
But it was only pretty much 2 months after they moved in together that she just one night disappeared, you know, no body, no murder weapon, no real motive that anyone could identify for any of these three men who were thought to be suspects or persons of interest. So it was just extremely puzzling to the sheriff's deputies.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, of course, the estranged husband, the boyfriend, did she have another boyfriend or who, can you tell us who's the third?
No.
No? Who was the third?
Yeah, so this is, no, well, yeah, I can tell you who the third is. This is one of the things that made the case so strange. So she disappears on a Tuesday night. And she doesn't work on Wednesdays, so no one even realizes she's gone. And very, very early, like 3 a.m. Thursday morning, the police pull over this white Pontiac driving down the street on the mainland. I think it had a taillight out or had run a red light. They pull it over. They, you know, they run the license plate, find that it belongs to this woman, Sabina Musil Bueller. And as they're doing all that, a man gets out from behind the steering wheel and runs away. So they, you know, they bring in all the deputies and the dogs. They search this entire neighborhood for him and finally find him underneath this pickup truck. This man named Robert Corona. And he tells them that, oh yeah, of course he had good reason to be in the car. He's been hanging out with Sabina Musil Bueller all night and she gave him the car to go get some drugs. So that kind of, this is suddenly they realize, okay, well, they don't really know what's going on. They call this woman's husband to see what's, you know, if he has any idea about this. He says, no, Sabina never would have loaned the guy this car. They go and see the boyfriend. He says, well, you know, I haven't seen her in a couple of days. We had a fight a couple of days ago and she just stormed off. That's like her. She's very, very passionate. And so they really didn't know what was going on or how to make heads or tails of this. And it wasn't until that Friday, when they've kind of had a chance to interview a bunch of people, they feel fairly certain that this is not just a missing persons case. This is much more serious. They go and they look at this car. You know, they use luminol to check for blood. And there is just a lot of blood on the car. There's blood in the trunk. There's blood on the passenger side seat where it looks like, you know, a body was put in and pulled out again. There's a place in the back seat that someone has covered up with stuff, but where the cushion has been cut away and this is all covered in blood. And that's really when the investigation took a very kind of dark and sinister turn.
Yeah, it would sound that way. Now, I can't figure out, so why did it take so long for them to resolve the case? Did they not find the body, or?
Exactly. So that was really the kind of the ultimate mystery there. You know, they, and I was in pretty close contact with the detectives working on this. One of them actually retired in the middle of the case and then came back out of retirement just because this cold case was driving him crazy. and they were just totally stumped. You know, they felt certain that she'd been murdered. They felt certain that she was somewhere on this island. When I first went down there, one of the strangest things, they were out on the beach with a backhoe and a professor of archaeology and a bunch of cadaver dogs, just digging around, hoping that they might strike on a body, basically. And they were just completely, I mean, they had a lot of ideas, and I think they had a pretty good idea of what had happened by the end, but right. Without a body, they were having such a hard time making a case. They were pretty, I don't know if this would be a good way, if it would be good to say what they were doing, desperate, but David at one point in time brought me in and asked me if I would wear a wire and go and talk to one of these men and just very bluntly say, I'm not writing a book of nonfiction, I'm writing a book of fiction. And if he had buried the body anywhere, where would he have done it? In a book of fiction.
An O.J. Simpson method. If I had killed her. Okay, and then there's
I, of course, didn't do that, by the way.
Now, but one thing that's curious is, why was the motel burned? Because he didn't need to burn down the motel.
So this is something, this was kind of the driving question for me, actually, through a lot of this. You know, I could see why one of these men might, in like a fit of rage or something, do something terrible, and commit a murder, right?
Right.
I couldn't understand why 2 weeks later, you know, 2 weeks have gone by, it's obvious the police have no clue what's going on. You know, after like the first 72 hours, there's almost no chance of finding a missing person. So it seems pretty obvious whoever did it had gotten away with it, right? And yet they're still in such tumult, still so torn up about this thing that they feel obliged to go back to this motel and set it on fire. That was so hard for me to wrap my mind around. And that's really kind of what drove a lot of the writing in the book, was trying to get into the psychology of the person who would do that.
Yeah. It seems weird.
And I don't think you could ever give a black and white answer about that. I don't think that the person who did it ever really had a good answer for it in their own mind. But I kind of think it has to do.
Well, it's some sort of distraction.
Go ahead.
I was going to say distraction. I mean, I could see it if you had the body in there and you wanted to burn it, or if you had evidence to burn. And
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, unless it was someone that just didn't like the husband, and you know, maybe it was nothing to do with her. Maybe it was to do with him, and he had an enemy that burned him out or something. You know what I'm saying? You know, there's other.
Yeah, things. Yeah.
It's just strange.
Yeah, there are definitely a lot of scenarios, you know, and one of the fascinating things early on was that they, of course, the spire seems extremely suspicious, right? They're looking very closely to make sure nothing was burned in there, at a lot of pains to make sure there are no bones or anything like that, right? And one of the strange things at first, that they thought that her pet parrot had been in there and that someone had taken it out before the fire was set and then set the fire, which if that was the case, it just shows such a strange set of logic, right? To be so angry on one hand and so thoughtful on the other or something.
Yeah. There's a lot of dynamics there. That's crazy. So now that you've got this under your belt, do you plan on doing more books? Is this kind of a future for you, or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, It's kind of what I studied in school and what I've always wanted to do. I don't think I'll do this project. Certainly became a lot darker and more personal to me than I had expected it to. You know, you spend enough time interviewing people about these things, you know, and I would sit down, for instance, with the missing woman's brother, and he would have all these photographs, and we'd go through them, and he'd tell me all about who his sister had been as a child and all this, and you could just see his jaw clenching and unclenching. And you can only do so many of those before you really start to feel affected yourself. And I was having these terrible, terrible nightmares about this missing woman. So I think the next project will be lighter.
Yeah,
is my only hope.
Yeah, it well, you know, I can say it comes and goes. I've got six true crime books out on murders, and
oh wow,
yeah, you know, and it comes and goes, because the one that I'm finishing up for May actually had a big impact on me. But more in a positive way than a negative. Because the other ones were always, you can get too much of that, I don't know what you call hate and murder in your mind because you're going through it all. And like you said, meeting people and talking and researching. And you kind of get that real weird, you know, weird negativity. And after a few books, it's bad. But then all of a sudden you come across one book and you're doing it and it makes you see things in a different light. I can say that this was, because it was a very hard case, but I'll tell you, it's changed me for the good, not for the bad. That's the best way I can cover it. So you just never know.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to say, although it took some time getting there, I did feel the same way about this project. You know, in the end, kind of reflecting on this relationship and on my own, it certainly made me a better husband.
Yeah, there's things you get out of it and you don't realize at the time. And then when you look back at it, you kind of go, wow. Or you change in some aspects, but you don't see it in yourself until later. And then when you're doing something, then it's kind of, that's the best way I can say it. So not that I'm promoting writing murder books or crime books, but there's also a positive impact that you can get out of it. You know, there's a lot of people that throw the negativity on it, but no, there is some good that can come from it.
I think my take on it is if you can recognize, you know, if you look at the psychology of someone who's done something very bad, if you can recognize some features of your own psychology in there, and how you can improve yourself from it, that to me is kind of the best possible thing you can take away from not just a book about crime, but about from any book.
Yeah. There's a lot. It's a lot more complex than just killing. So. Wow. So anyway.
Yeah. If anything, killing is like the simplest part.
Yeah, that's kind of like just the end game, but there's so much more to it. Well, so now your book is available now. It's available everywhere, and of course, Amazon. And it's Love and Death in the Sunshine State. And that's the story of a crime. And that's brought to you by Cutter Wood. Thank you for taking the time, being on the show, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Now it's time for Dr. Joe's Conspiracy Countdown of the Week.
Well, welcome back. And joining me now, we've got Joe Yusinski. How you doing, Joe?
Very good. Thanks for having me back on this week. Always great to be with you doing the Conspiracy Countdown.
Always. So have you got any real goodies for us this week, or is it kind of a slow week?
Well, I've got three goodies, and two of them focus on current events because of the airstrikes in Syria. But before I get to that, I did want to say that we lost somebody big in the conspiracy world this week, and that's Art Bell, who passed away last week at the age of 72, and he was very big into the mysticism and conspiracy and aliens and paranormal for a long, long time. And that's a big loss for the community out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. There's tributes all over. And, you know, he really started the... he really started it on radio. I don't think anybody else was before him. So it kind of... He became known as the conspiracy and alternative history kind of guy.
And the thing is, I don't know whether to mourn or not, because I'm worried I'm going to find out in a year that he faked his own death for some weird reason.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah.
It would only make sense.
Well, that'll probably come up anyway, whether he did or didn't.
Yeah.
You know, or he's going to be somewhere on the moon or... Planet X. But, you know. Well, here we go. So,
well, speaking of Planet X, so you stole a little bit of my thunder. So number three this week, we have an important prediction. On April 23rd, it has been predicted by conspiracy theorists that the planet Nibiru, sometimes called Planet X, is heading right towards us and will hit us in about a week and a half. And there's sort of a conflict in the theory here, and the theory is that it's going to come here and kill us all, but then it's going to leave in October and start the apocalypse. So I don't know if it's going to kill us twice or what, but it is heading right towards us, say conspiracy theorists. You can't see it in your regular telescope. You can only see it in the NASA telescopes, but NASA won't tell us that they're seeing this planet barreling right at us.
Why can you see it in their telescope and not anybody else's?
Because like the lizard people, they exist only in invisible light and not in the visible light that we can detect.
Oh. And, okay, so the other thing is this... Well, there you go. But this is the at least third or fourth... you know, suggestions that it's the end of the world. Like, this is the third or fourth date now I've heard over the last 2 years or something. How come it keeps changing? Is there...
Well, I've been very concerned about the upcoming midterm elections in November, and I guess now I don't have to be. And that's sort of the good thing. And I guess we'll all be out of our misery by then.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you don't have to worry. It doesn't matter who gets in. They won't.
But this one is actually good, though, because it's sort of the theory is giving itself two shots to get it right. So it says it'll be here April 23rd and kill us, and it will kill us again in October. So I guess if it's a miss in April, there's a backstop there.
Oh, maybe for the ones that don't get killed, right? I mean, don't they have underground bunkers set up?
Well, you know, when you get into the Christian apocalypse, it's sort of weird because it's like some people are going to go to heaven right away. Some people are going to stay wandering around. But everybody's in trouble unless Jesus takes you immediately.
Oh. Oh.
So I guess if we're still here in May, that means we did something wrong.
Well, I think I will be because I've done plenty wrong. And I continue.
We'll still be broadcasting in May through the apocalypse.
Oh, of course, but just for the people that do things wrong.
And probably none of our listeners will. Well, all of our listeners will still be here too. So.
Oh yeah, because they're all sinners. Come on. Wow, interesting. Well, we'll see what happens.
Okay, so moving on. Assuming we're not all dead next week. Number two is that the gassing attacks taking place in Syria are actually a conspiracy put on to justify further military actions in Syria. And this is actually a pretty big conspiracy theory right now. And there's a lot of people who believe that the evidence for the gas attacks is weak and that it has been planted. And that it's just a big morass over there, and that this is all a false flag set up by the government to get us potentially into a World War III with Russia.
Oh. Okay, so the government's, like, just kind of made these videos falsely, and they're promoting it, saying, look at this, and then...
They use child crisis actors to fake a gas attack.
Wow. I mean, what does a child crisis actor get paid?
Well, they have to join the union first. So that's $3,000 to the Screen Actors Guild, apparently, and then you can be a crisis actor.
Wow, that might be a good job.
So they will not just hire you off the street. You have to be in the union. If not, you're a scab.
Well, I'll have to get in the union. And that might be a good job. You get to see the world. There's plenty of work.
See the world. You only have to do one thing on camera, and that's die. Pretend to die every time. So it's a straightforward acting.
Yeah. Well, this is good. This is good. It's better than a soap opera. People will respect your work more.
Yes. And that leads us directly into our number one for the week, and which ties into it. And that is, this was put forward by Alex Jones. And what's interesting is that Alex Jones was one of Trump's biggest supporters. He's now pulled back some of that support. And he's apparently irate with Trump for launching the attacks in Syria. And he believes that the deep state has gotten to Trump and taken Trump over and forced him to launch these attacks. So whereas Trump had run on a non-interventionist platform, he's now going on these military expeditions around the world, and Jones does not like it.
Right, right. And that sort of surprised me, because I heard some rumblings over this last few days and about Alex Jones being really mad and saying all sorts of bad things, but I almost didn't believe it. You know, I just thought, yeah, whatever. He's not really. So he really is upset with Trump then.
I mean, it's been reported that way. I mean, there are the quotes, you know, F Trump. I mean, are pretty clear in their meaning. So.
Well, that's pretty direct. Well, that's crazy. I didn't expect that to happen. So where would his buddy Roger Stone sit?
Well, that's an interesting question, because Stone is sort of a closet libertarian and probably is not that keen on the nation building and the world police. But who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. So are we seeing Trump turn into Obama in that sort of fashion?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that we saw Obama turn into Bush.
Right.
And now we're seeing Trump turn into Obama. And if people think that they're getting a peace candidate with Obama or Trump, they're not.
No.
And it's, you know, essentially people think that you elect a new person, you're going to get a new style of leadership. And it doesn't really happen that way, because there are so many forces at play that most of the choices you think a president has are really already made for them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I kind of figure that you see this happen, whether it's a Bush, Obama, or Trump, or Clinton, it all turns into the same, because I think they also get into government, into the presidency, and they find out a lot of things they didn't know.
And, or have incentives that they didn't have before.
Yeah, there's kind of, I think it's a big combination game, as well as, like you say, the other forces. And, of course, there's always the deep state.
Yeah. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie Wag the Dog, I mean, that sort of lies out this way that we could interpret military action by the president. I mean, if Americans are so into the idea of just bombing other countries.
Yeah.
Like, they're doing, just bomb them. So when a president does that, you know, they immediately get a lot of public approval.
Yeah.
And Trump's numbers have been going up, and they'll probably continue to go up because of this.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing the same thing. And I like the people that are putting on quotes of that he made when Obama was starting to bomb and get into it, that it's because his numbers were low.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of doing the same thing, you know. I don't think it really changes. I think that they kind of fall into line and start proceeding how that the other ones do. It's just the only thing different usually is some sort of social or sometimes economic changes in the country. But
I mean, there are better ways to deal with these problems because it's such a morass over there. You really can't get involved and expect anything good to happen, particularly in the short term. But, I mean, the one thing you could do is do humanitarian aid and then take refugees. And Trump is against, you know, taking any refugees. So you wind up with a lot of people being stuck in a place where he's dropping bombs.
Yeah, you know, and that's a real, that's an interesting point because they don't want the refugees, the current administration. But yet dropping the bombs and doing, doesn't it create enemies in a way?
It does, and we don't know who we're fighting for or against.
Yeah.
There's so many factions. There's a really good Woody Allen movie called Bananas, where they send the CIA over to a Latin American country, and the military is asking, you know, whose side are we on now? And the CIA said, well, some of us are going to be for, some of us will be against. We want to make sure we have all our bases covered.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. It's wonderful. It's kind of funny, you know, in a way. If it wasn't so serious, it would be real funny. But anyway. Well, Joe, it's been another great week. And don't forget, listeners, that coming up on Monday, May 7th, to Friday the 11th, for the whole week, all stations, all nine stations will be having a Dr. Joe, Conspiracy Countdown Marathon.
So, all right. Well, so, I will be listening to that.
So you'll be excited. It's you can't get enough Joe. Well, you won't. It's going to just go all week long. So we'll look forward to that.
Well, I'm excited.
Well, thanks again, Joe. We'll talk
Thank
to you,
you
next week.
I'm Nancy Grace, and I'm on the House of Mystery.
Coming up next, Stephen David Lampley delivers his true crime commentary.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
All right, welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. And as usual, I am Stephen David Lampley. So I've had some inquiries regarding my upcoming book on Jeffrey Dahmer, and I wanted to give some of you an update. The book is in process. I expect it to be available for sale sometime, probably closer to the latter part of March. One of the unique things about this book is that I do have a copy of the FBI case file, as well as Jeffrey Dahmer's confession, and I will be putting parts of that in the book. The actual copy of the page will be in the book so you can see. So I expect that sometime out, probably toward the end of March. All right, now over the next few commentaries, we're going to be discussing human decomposition. Now, don't get all grossed out over it. We're going to be talking about human decomposition specifically as it applies to homicide investigations. And there's a wealth of information, and it's a pretty cool science involved with being able to investigate and use what you have, the insects and the time frame and the body decomposition rate, the temperature. There's a lot of factors that go into that. It's really truly an amazing science. But if you're a fan of any of the true crime related TV shows, you obviously see and hear a great deal about homicides. And I believe you're going to find these commentary segments not only informative, but probably pretty interesting, I hope. All right, there is a handout available with this first segment. If you'll go to StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts, plural, with an S, StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts. Just go down to Composition Fresh, And you'll be able to click on that. It is in PDF form, and you have two options. You can read it online as we go along, or we have made it printer friendly for color, margins, and black and white print. You can print that out and keep it and follow along as well. All right, that's StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts. All right, now decomposition is simply the process by which organic organisms break down. That's it. That's all there is to it. Now, the speed and manner in which decomposition takes place depends on a number of factors. A couple of those are humidity, temperature, and even what the victim had to eat prior to their death impacts the speed and manner in which decomposition takes place. Now, let's go ahead and give you the stages so that sort of sets the stage for the commentaries to come. The various stages of decomposition are fresh, bloat, active decay, advanced decay, and then dry or remains or skeletal, which is, of course, the end. Now, fresh decomposition is the very beginning of human decomposition. It begins immediately upon the heart ceasing to beat. I mean, it starts instantly. And it usually lasts 1 to 2 days, depending on the environment. The fresh decomposition stage is typically not visible outside the body. You usually don't start noticing decomposition effects until you reach the second phase, which is the bloat stage. The blood, since it is not being pumped by the heart, it begins to settle inside the body. And the body begins to turn a bluish or purplish color. This discoloration is called livor mortis or lividity. Now, also what happens is the body begins to cool. And under normal conditions, the cooling rate is about 1.6 degrees per hour. And this is also sometimes called the death chill. But like I said, in normal conditions, just average environment, we're looking at a decreased rate of the temperature of the body of 1.6 degrees per hour. Now, since the heart is no longer pumping blood through the body, the blood is unable to provide oxygen to tissues and can no longer remove the carbon dioxide. Now, as a result of that, there's a decrease in the pH, and then processes of cell structure, they lose their structure and begin to fall apart. And as a result of that, it facilitates a cellular enzyme release that begins to break down the body, or if you will, to eat itself, is what some people would call it, or the breakdown of cells and tissues. Now, because of the remaining oxygen that remains in the body, aerobic microbes take that in, and thus it creates a situation for anaerobic organisms. These anaerobic organisms multiply and begin consuming the carbs, the lipids, and the proteins, and then they cause to be produced various acids, methane, hydrogen sulfide, and ammonia. And this is called putrefaction, and then causes the second phase of decomposition, or bloating. Now, we're going to end here just shortly, but I got a couple of seconds. And I want to briefly go over with you a very, very simplified time frame of decomposition. Now, of course, when the heart stops beating, decomposition begins instantly. It doesn't wait around an hour or two or a few minutes to see if the heart's going to start pumping again. Once the heart ceases to beat, decomposition sets right in. Now, rigor mortis typically will take effect 2 to 6 hours after death, and typically rigor mortis will last about a 24-ish hour period, somewhere in there. Now, livor mortis begins around 8 to 10 hours after death, and that's where you change to a purplish-brown color because of the pooling of the blood. You're going to smell an odor. And again, all this is relative to the environment and where the body is located. But in general terms, you're going to smell an odor in about 3 days. And then about 8 days from that, the body is going to turn a reddish brown. And it's going to start to become unrecognizable. I mean, you'll be able to tell that it's obviously a human body. But as far as who it is, you're going to be a little harder. But as far as who it is, it's going to be a little harder to tell. You'll be a little unrecognizable. Now, One thing is pretty interesting is that if a human body is buried in the ground with no coffin, no preparation, just put in the ground and covered up, the decomposition rate is around 12 years, give or take. Maybe 10, maybe 14. It'll be around 12 years. Now, underwater, if a person is dead and is underwater, the decomposition rate is 4 times faster underwater than it is above ground. Then this will come in handy if you're watching television, watch one of the crime shows, and they start talking about the decomposition rate or when this person was killed based on the body decomposition. You're gonna know a little bit about this. And that's why I do these commentaries. I want to give you the real information, the factual information, and the information so you can watch TV and say, hey, I know about that. That's right. So anyway, listen, I'm going to get off here. My time is up. And come back next week, and we're going to begin the bloat series. Now, I'm not going to gross you out, okay? I'm not going to submit photos or put diagrams on the handouts that's going to make you sick. I'm going to give you some stuff that you can use and then some things you can learn, okay? All right, well, I'm out of here, and we'll see you next time, and we'll talk about bloat. Have a good day.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.